Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for the invitation. I wanted to do mainly two things. First of all, to introduce this notion of moral luck, the problem of moral luck. The second thing is to defend the idea of moral luck against the critics. And if I still have time, which I doubt, I'll try on you a new paper that I'm writing right now, which uses the idea of a moral luck to solve some problem in the philosophy of criminal law, particularly regarding self-defense. Okay. So let me start by just reminding you of the obvious, which we tend to disregard. And the obvious is that so many aspects of our life depend on luck. Now, by luck, I don't mean necessarily events that we have no control over. There might be states of affairs that we have some partial responsibility for and some partial control. The point is that there are parts of that state of affairs which are not within our control, okay? So I'm using the notion of luck in a bit of a technical sense, and that's the same in all the literature about moral luck. When we say luck, don't think about lottery or events that have no causes or something or things like that, or something which is a complete surprise. The notion of luck is used in a bit of a technical sense to refer to things we don't have control over. Okay, what's not within our control is a matter of luck in that respect. Okay, so I traveled all the way here from Bad Homburg. Although I wrote a lot on the topic, I did my homework. I sat down for an hour or so to prepare this lecture. I prepared notes. I thought about the audience and so on. All that was within my control, okay? But I knew very well already on the way here that even though I made all those preparations, it might not work out as I wanted to. I mean, it might be the case that instead of, I don't know, 15 people or so, only 3 will show up because of bad weather, because there's some party in the city or the university, I don't know what, or because they heard that the lecture is boring. Maybe of the 3 people who show up, or 5 people, some of them would be kind of very aggressive in the discussion, and I won't be able to handle the questions properly. So I walk out in the end of the evening frustrated, maybe a bit humiliated. I mean, why did I do all this? Now, those aspects are completely not within my control. They would be, it won't happen, don't worry, but they would be a matter of bad luck for me, and that would ruin my day or my week. That's a very small example, but this example, as I indicated, really exists in all aspects of our life. There are, in many critical junctions, aspects of our decisions which are within our control, but then there's a sea of possible events which are and results which are not within our control. So take a rather major decision, whether to get married and with whom to get married. Okay, so people regard this as quite an important decision, and it is, right? So once people used to get married very early, and then you say, no, that's too early. So maybe if you're older, in the late 20s and early 30s, you'll make a better decision. You'll have more control about the results. You can know your partner better. Oops, doesn't work like that. I mean, the rates of divorce are, I'm not sure about Europe, in America I think it's now 50% or around 50%. And then there was the idea, okay, maybe we should live together before the wedding so the partners would know each other even better. And again, all those would be ways to prevent the role of luck to control the future, but it doesn't really work, or it works only in a limited way. By the way, I think I read some research that couples cohabiting before marriage have actually a higher chance of getting divorced. That's at least in America. Never mind. So when we look at many aspects of our life, we notice that a lot of them, a lot of these aspects depend on luck. And when we have these thoughts, they're pretty depressing. Why are they depressing? First of all, they give us a sense of lack of control over our lives, which is depressing. We feel we don't really control our lives. That what happens to us and the direction our lives take is arbitrary. We married that girl only because we happened to meet her at that specific course, and all the other girls were so ugly or you know, unfriendly, so she looked to us like an angel. And I married them, this is what happened. Or I happened to live in some place, and this is the job that was offered. I took that job, and it took me wherever it took me. Just bad luck. Look, one looks back at one's life miserably, in the sense of my life had no direction, I had no control over it. So this is one aspect of the depression. The other aspect of the depression is that it raises pessimism about justice in the world, because it seems that the goods in the world are distributed in an arbitrary manner. Nobody has real control. It's just fortuna who, you know, distributes the goods of the world with no real control. So these thoughts were experienced as depressing for thinkers for many years. One reaction to this reality, or this recognition of the reality, which is familiar from ancient philosophy, from the Stoic philosophy, is to concede that a lot depends on luck, that we are vulnerable to all kinds of luck. However, to add, that there is some aspect of our lives which is immune to luck. And second, that this aspect of life is incredibly important. So the idea would be something like that. That sure, if our stocks, succeed in the stock market, is a matter of luck. And if you make your well-being depend on your economic situation, you're in a bad state. So the solution is to develop a kind of indifference to your bank account, to your business, to your material properties or whatever. You're just indifferent to that. So of course it's bad luck if your house is burnt down in a fire, but you really don't care so much about your house. So all those aspects of life which are vulnerable to luck are such that we ought to detach ourselves from them, to regard them as not really important, to accept them in a kind of a stoic mood. We don't really care about them. Now, it's not that we don't care about anything. There are some things we do care about, and those things we care about are essentially, or to a very large extent, immune to luck. And these are mainly qualities of the mind. Okay, so the idea is that if I develop the mind, or if I develop my character properly, that's up to me. I mean, I can lose my money, I can be laughed at, I could be expelled, I could suffer all kinds of material losses. That doesn't really touch me. What is up to me is to develop my character, or various qualities of the mind, and these goods really are immune to luck. Nobody can really touch them. And this goes back to famous sayings of Socrates in the Crito, when he laughs at Crito and his students who try to convince him to escape, and he says that the masses can't really harm us, and generally he said a good person Nothing bad can happen to a good person. Which in first reading sounds a bit crazy, but when you go into the philosophy of Socrates, you understand what he says. I mean, if you define good and evil properly according to those things which are really good and bad, then nobody can really touch the good person. You can imprison the good person, Socrates. You can execute the good person. You don't really harm him. Okay. The problem with the Stoic solution is A, that such a life demands an incredibly hard and long process of training. It's not just a matter of decision. You need to train yourself to stop caring so much, as some of us do, about our money, our homes, our friends, our family, our cities, our countries, our football teams, or whatever. That's a lot of effort, because naturally we do care about these things, okay? That's the first problem. The second is that this way of life, the kind of Stoic way of life, which is characterized by this self-sufficiency, by this detachment from anything that is vulnerable to lack, means that we need to detach ourselves from many things that we very highly value, not only money. It's also family and friends. People here who have children know that once you have children, you are completely at the mercy of luck. I mean, if God forbid anything happens to your child, I mean, your life is ruined, right? So, and if your child is upset, you're upset. If the child is sick, you feel sick. So now let's assume you have a big family. I wish you all big families. So, and then you have kids and grandkids. So, I mean, the bigger the family, the more vulnerable you are to anything bad that would happen to any of them. Problems of health, economic problems, whatever. So, this is something we highly value. And if the Stoic way of escaping the problem of luck with which I started, if the price is to give up the notion of family and of friends and so on, this seems a rather high price to pay. I mean, I guess most of us would prefer this vulnerability with all the pessimism it brings with it, I mentioned earlier, over giving up these human relationships. Okay. Religious views offer their own answers, which are often very similar to the Stoic one in their structure, and they add to the Stoic solution divine assistance. Why is that important? Because God guarantees that in the end everything somehow gets okay. So that sense I mentioned earlier of ultimate injustice in the world, that is solved if you believe that somehow God, you know, arranges everything, and at the end of days or whatever, everything, your efforts will be recognized, and justice will prevail. But what would do somebody who doesn't believe in such a God who kind of organizes the world according to justice, and also isn't too enthusiastic by the Stoic solution? Is there any other way of confronting the grim reality I described? So here's the answer which we're going to focus on today. And the answer is that one way to overcome this sense of futility, meaninglessness, and so on is by morality. So we have the same structure like in the Stoa. So here's the structure. True, much of life depends on luck, which is unfortunate. However, there is an aspect of our lives which does not depend on luck, And this aspect is extremely important and valuable. It's far more valuable than any other value. And what is this aspect or this value? This is morality. So there are really three premises here. The first is that the realization of moral value or of morality is not a matter of luck, but is completely within our control. It's up to us. Second, that in this respect, I mean, in the up to usness, in this respect, all human beings are equal. You don't need any special education, any special training. Like Kant says, every human being knows the moral imperative. You don't need a course in ethics for that. The categorical imperative, the basic moral law, can be known and is known by everybody. And therefore, everybody can attain, can obey the moral law. Okay. The third is that moral value or attaining moral value is far supreme to all other values. Okay, that's the most important thing, to keep my moral integrity, to be a moral person. So again, you can harm me, you can destroy my property, you can take my money, but insofar as you don't touch my moral integrity, you leave me with what is most important for me. Okay? And I can keep a smile or keep calm against my perpetrators or you know, people who are after my property. You can take all that, that's not important for me. What's important for me is to maintain my moral integrity. Of course, the case shouldn't be overstated. I mean, the claim is not that via morality we are completely saved from you know bad things in the world. But as I said, since morality is so important, that's really what defines us as human beings, as excellent human beings. The other things are really not very important. They can't be harmed. It would be, you know, unfortunate if they are harmed, but that's not very important, really. Okay. So, in this line of thought, luck and morality are two opposing notions, because morality, in its essence, is what is within our control. So morality essentially is not a matter of luck. So if somebody fails morally and you say, hey, why did he do that? So you say, oh, I had bad luck. That would sound like a joke. Behaving immorally is not a matter of bad luck. It's a matter of a bad decision. It's a moral failure. The philosopher who is the classic source for this approach to the relation between luck and morality is Kant. And this is the first source on the handout, the very famous paragraph in the beginning of the Grundwerk. The goodwill, which we could also translate as the moral will, is not good because of what it affects or accomplishes, or because of its adequacy to achieve some proposed end. It is good only because of its willing, i.e. it is good of itself. And regarded for itself, it is to be esteemed incomparably higher than anything which could be brought about by it in favor of any inclination or even of the sum total of all inclinations. Even if it should happen that by a particularly unfortunate fate or by the niggardly provision of a step motherly nature, this will should be wholly lacking in power to accomplish its purpose, And even if the greatest effort should not avail it to achieve anything of its end, and if there remained only the goodwill, not as mere wish, but as the summoning of all the means in our power, it would sparkle like a jewel in its own right. It would sparkle like a jewel in its own right, as something that had its full worth in itself. Usefulness or fruitlessness can neither diminish nor augment this worth. So, I act out of goodwill. Let's say I make a big effort to donate money to the poor or to the sick. As Kant emphasizes, not as a mere wish. It's not that I only had this idea in my mind. No, no. I actually translate this wish to real means in the world. Okay? I take my checkbook, I write a check, I take an envelope, you know, I do everything that's within my control. But then, you know, people say that some of these organizations that are supposed to help the poor poorly fail in their mission, and there's some corruption and waste of money, so on, so on. So let's assume that my check did no good to anybody. Okay, definitely not to the poor. It didn't reach anywhere. Bad luck, right? So the question is whether this bad luck affects the moral status of the person who sent the check. So Kant would say, not at all. Not at all. The usefulness or fruitlessness can neither diminish nor augment this worth. If the world doesn't cooperate, so to say, with my goodwill, makes no difference. What determines moral value is the goodwill. And the same goes for bad will. So if I plan to murder somebody and I prepare everything, again, it's not a mere wish, I prepare the weapon, I prepare I have a complete plan, and I pull the trigger and I miss. Bad luck for me. My plan didn't work out. Does the fact that I didn't kill the person, does that make any difference? Again, Kant would say, no, it makes no difference. It doesn't kind of correct my bad will. All the negative points I got for intending, for trying to kill the person, are still with me. They're not cancelled, they're not reformed or corrected because I missed. The idea that luck should not affect our normative judgments appears also sometimes in legal systems, because there's a general expectation that legal systems should at least be compatible with morality, okay? Should at least not be unjust. So Kant's intuition is that to make moral status depends on factors which are outside our control is unjust. Because we have no control over it, right? So to translate that into legal terms would mean that the person who attempts to murder but fails, and the person who attempts to murder and succeeds, should get the same punishment, right? The first person actually did nothing, harmed nobody. He put the trigger, nothing happened. The other person succeeded and killed the victim. So if we take the Kantian line, we should treat them in a similar way. There was a very big revision in the criminal law in Israel some 20 years ago, And one of the changes in law was to determine precisely this point, that the punishment of criminal attempt would be the same as a successful attempt. And in the explanation for this law that came to the Knesset, the legislator said that it doesn't make any sense to have punishment depend on luck. Doesn't make any sense. So we have, as you know, two main rationales for punishment. One would be retribution, and the other would be all kinds of utilitarian considerations. So either way, these considerations seem to apply the same in these two cases. I mean, somebody who tried to murder just didn't work is surely as evil as the person who succeeded. It's just a matter of luck. So in terms of what they deserve, they definitely deserve the same punishment. They did the same. The world intervened and changed things, but they did the same. They have the same corrupt character, the same corrupt intentions and so on. Okay. Some of what I said, especially with Kant, might sound a bit too philosophical, but I think the main idea is known to every child. Nothing too clever about it. I mean the idea that it's unfair to blame people, to hold them responsible for what was not within their control. And that's the kind of the most natural reaction of even young kids. When you say, when you blame for them, say, hey, it wasn't my fault. Okay? Okay. This is the background against which two great moral philosophers write very influential papers in 1976, challenging this very widespread idea. And these are Bernard Williams, the British philosopher, and Tom Nagel from New York. Both of them attacked this Kantian idea of immunity to luck, of morality being immune to luck, and argued that we must recognize the fact that luck inescapably affects moral status. I will refer mainly to Nagel, though in the discussion we might talk about Williams too. So Nagel presents four ways in which luck affects morality, affects moral judgments. The first is resultant luck, or luck in results. And that would apply to the case of the two assassins which I just mentioned. Okay? So, though we have control over some results, many results of our actions are such that we don't have control over them. So I'll just mention another example which became kind of classic in the literature. So take two drivers, both driving negligently, as we all do sometimes, right? One of them gets home safely without causing any accident, no problem. Goes to sleep, doesn't know from anything, feels okay. I mean, he's not troubled at all by what just happened, that he drove, let's say, too fast. Or the other driver behaves exactly in the same way, and causes a car accident or hits a pedestrian. Okay, So in terms of what was within their control, namely the way they drove, there's no difference between them. Okay? There's the same kind of bad will, or at least negligible will, or indifferent will, or whatever. So in that sense, there's no difference at all between them. The difference was a matter of the word. In the lucky guy, in the lucky driver case, the word was kind and let the driver go to sleep with no problems. In the other case, the world was less kind and sent another car in a junction, or sent a pedestrian there, and there was an accident. So, according to the Kantian idea, we should regard the successful and the failed assassins as morally equal. Maybe we should hang both of them. And also we should regard the two drivers as morally equal. Right? We don't charge them for what was the world responsibility. We charge them only for what was within their control. However, argues Neger, this is absurd. Because the driver himself, as well as people from the outside, regard these two cases as very much different. I mean, I just killed the guy. And it won't help me if you said, well, yeah, it wasn't your fault. What do you mean it wasn't your fault? Okay, I drove negligently and I hit a guy. I know you drove negligently too, but you didn't hit the guy and I did. Okay? So I perceive myself as a killer, as somebody who killed a human being. And other people also regard me the same way. I should add in brackets, as you know, of course, from a legal point of view, it also makes a huge difference. If you speed, so you might get a ticket. So if two drivers speed, 200 kilometers per hour, so they get a high fine to pay. If one of them is unlucky and kills a human being, that's could be manslaughter, or that could be very serious. They don't get the same punishment. Okay, so that's resultant luck. The second type of luck, which Nagel mentions, is what he calls circumstantial luck. Luck in the circumstances. And this is luck in the moral tests that we face. So let's say you're an American soldier fighting in Iraq, and your unit is planned to go into Fallujah the following week, and you caught the flu. You have high fever. Okay, so. Your officer says, stay in the barracks or in your tent. You can't bring us any help. And your unit goes to Fallujah the following day. And some soldiers, or maybe the unit in general, is involved in problematic actions in Fallujah. Okay? War crimes or something close to war crimes. So now let's compare a soldier that was there in Fallujah. I mean, I'm not arguing anything about the facts of Fallujah, of course, here. So let's compare a soldier who was actually there in Fallujah and let's assume committed some war crimes to that soldier with the flu. Is there any difference between them? So first of all, let's look at the role of luck. It's clearly just a matter of luck that this guy got fever and wasn't there with his comrades, right? Just a matter of luck. In this particular case, let's assume that this soldier was no different than the others. I mean, there's no reason in the world to think he would behave differently. So let's assume there's a good basis to assuming that had this soldier not caught the flu, had he gone to Fallujah with his unit, he would have behaved just as bad as everybody else did. But he didn't. He would have just slept in the tent the entire day. So according to the Kantian notion, if we're supposed to neutralize luck from the picture, we should say that there's no moral difference between this soldier and the other soldiers. Okay? It's just a matter of luck that he wasn't there. By the way, this is a kind of an argument we often use when we are blamed by somebody of doing such and such. We say, hey, you guy, if you were there, you would behave the same way. So, you know, you stop telling me off. You're not in a position to tell me off because you would behave in the same way. So don't, you know, pretend that you have a higher moral status that allows you to tell me off. Okay. I'll add another example which Nagel mentioned, which I think is helpful. There's a big philosophical discussion about the notion of moral dilemmas. So according to some philosophers, and Nagel would be among them, there are situations in which agents are under the yoke, so to say, of two conflicting moral obligations, which are incompatible. So I ought to do A, I ought to do B, and in this situation, it's not the case that I can do both A and B. Okay, so I'm trapped in the situation. According to Nagel, this would be a perfect case of bad moral luck. It wasn't within my control to be in this situation, let's assume. That's standard. And it's not within my control to get out of the situation without doing evil, without doing wrong. I'm just forced to do something wrong. Either I act against A or against B. I just can't, there's no way I can satisfy these two obligations. Okay. So it's interesting, if you look at the literature, those philosophers who believe in what they call the reality of moral dilemmas also believe in the reality of moral luck. So that would apply to Williams, to Nagel, to Martha Nussbaum, and others. These notions are connected. Okay, so that's the second notion. The third notion, the third way that morality, that luck influences morality, is what Nagel calls constitutive luck. By which he means our character traits, which to a large extent, almost completely, are not really within our control. I mean, when we are young, even younger, we think that we look at our parents and we say, no, we don't want to be like our parents, we're going to be different. We have our own way of doing things, I have my own character, blah, 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 blah. The older we get, at least in my case, I can say, I realized how much we are like our parents. There's something depressing about it, which is not unrelated to depressing thoughts I mentioned at the outset. I mean, the lack of control. So you're When you're old enough, you know, not to feel you have to fight against your parents and kind of you can take a look at them from afar a bit. So you just see their responses, and then you look at yourself and you see how much your ultimate, your kind of basic way of responding to people is influenced by parents. We see it on ourselves, we see it on friends. So it's a matter of to a large extent our character traits are determined by our genes, maybe also by the upbringing. I always find it amusing when people think that somebody with a really awful character can, you know, it's that person's responsibility. I mean, the idea of Nagel, of course, is that this is not within our control. To a large extent, it's not within our control. And that people can deny this and think that it is within our control. Just go to therapy. You know, for 1, 2, 3, maybe 50 years, and then you can kind of change the basic structure kind of your character just by therapy. That looks to me an incredible illusion. But in any case, that's Nagel's view. And of course, the character we have influences our actions, our behaviors. And therefore, to a large extent, this is not within our control, the way we behave. And this, of course, applies to the good and to the bad. I mean, I used to be a teacher at high school many years ago, and there's a parents' evening. And often for me, it was kind of comforting because sometimes I have this awful student, really so annoying, and then when I see the parents, I say to myself, I mean, what can you expect? Really? What can you expect? The parents are so aggressive and unbearable. So that's only to be expected. And the same with the nice kids. You see the parents, now you understand this jewel. Okay, so that's the third way that luck influences morality. And the last one is familiar with from discussions about determinism, is the idea that our very acts of the will, are determined by prior causes, which is the view of anybody who believes in determinism. Now, what I think so powerful about this way of presenting the matter is that even if you deny determinism and you believe in free will, what philosophers call libertarian free will, which means that our acts of will can start new causal chains, okay? I mean, that's the notion of libertarian free will. That when I want, I can want something, this very willing of something itself is not determined by prior causes. It's me who creates, who initiates a new causal chain. Okay, this is the idea of libertarian free will. So even if one accepts this idea of free will, that is not enough to immunize us from luck. Why? So the clear example is, of course, luck in the results, result in luck. So even if my wanting X is completely within my control, metaphysically, still, the minute my will touches the world, so to say, it depends on the cooperation of the world. Okay? And so, even if we do have libertarian free will, then we still depend on luck in the types of challenges or tests we face, like in Fallujah, in the results of our actions, like in the case of the drivers and the assassins, and so on. So we have kind of luck, thrown at us from all directions. So much so that, as we shall soon see, it seems like, you know, nothing is left for us. Everything seems to depend on luck. So what would the critics say against Nagel and Williams, against this line of thought? So one quite central criticism of Nagel is that there's really no paradox here, and these examples of the drivers and the assassins and so on can be taken care of very well without assuming that luck affects morality. Okay? So let's talk about the drivers. So they are right, Nagel is right, that we judge these drivers differently. He's right about that. Nagel's explanation is that luck affects our judgments. Here, say the critics, he's wrong. Why is he wrong? There's a different explanation. What is a different explanation? So here it goes. In the real world, not in the world of philosophers, you know, who have serious imagination and so on, in the real world, in most cases, almost all cases, the way that corrupt character or intentions is revealed is through actions in the real world. Okay? So we have no kind of godlike eye or ear to know what's going on in people's heads, what they really intend of doing to do and so on. What we do see is actual actions. So in the real world, we have to rely on that. That's not perfect, that's true. So when the would-be killer, the failed assassin, and when the lucky driver get to heaven, just as a metaphor, then God knows exactly what everybody deserves, and everybody will get exactly what they deserve. But we over here, with our limited knowledge, we can't make those judgments here. In other words, the notion of luck is only an epistemic notion, and not moral. Okay, so we do rely on what actually happens, on what people actually do, but that doesn't mean that what happens in the actual world is by itself morally significant. It's not. What actually happens in the world is morally insignificant, makes no difference. It's just a good way to know things about the actor, about the agent. Okay. So this is a seems to be a good challenge to Nagel. It's a good challenge because it kind of concedes the examples. You're right, we do make these distinctions between drivers and assassins and so on with the soldiers. I mean, with the soldiers, it's even better. I mean, the critics would say, again, from God's point of view, if it is the case that the sick soldier would have behaved the same, he'll go to the same place in hell like the other soldiers when they get, you know, to the day of judgment. But we've no way of knowing that. No one in the world of knowing that. I mean, even in the famous experiments of Milgram, people didn't react exactly the same, right? So people do behave differently in situations. So we have no idea. We have no idea, as pathetic human beings with limited knowledge, we have no way to say that this what somebody would have done in these circumstances. These are just pure guesses. Okay. So what could Nagel offer in response to that? If all he can offer is examples, and you know, adding more examples, that really won't be, I think, won't be enough. Because the critics would again concede the examples and offer their own way of understanding them. And they would insist that in terms of the goodwill, like Kant said, we don't care about the world. We care only about what's within our control. So I think they need a stronger argument, and I would like to point to two arguments. One that is offered by Nagel is based on the importance of agency, and this is the second rather long citation, which I'll have to skip a bit. But let's try. The problem arises, I believe, because the self which acts and is the object of moral judgment is threatened with dissolution by the absorption of its facts, of its acts and impulses into the class of events. Moral judgment of a person is judgment not of what happens to him, but of him. It does not say merely that a certain event or state of affairs is fortunate or unfortunate or even terrible. It is not an evaluation of a state of the world or of an individual as part of the world. We are judging him rather than his existence or characteristics. The effect of concentrating on the influence of what is not under his control is to make this responsible self seem to disappear, swallowed up by the order of mere events. What, however, do we have in mind that a person must be to be the object of these moral attitudes? Though I cannot define the idea of the active self that is thus undermined, it is possible to say something about its sources. Maybe I should just stop for a second just to make sure we understand what's going on. So, once we understand these different ways that luck affects us, nothing seems to be left for our agency. I mean, if our character is not within our control, we kind of don't own it. It's a matter of our genes and our upbringing, which we had no control over. And then, if the minute our will touches the world, from there on, it's not within our control. And remember, we are creatures that act in the world, okay? So if we are supposed to kind of isolate, when we judge people, whatever is not within their control, we need to kind of isolate from them or take out from them everything that has to do with touching the world. So what's going to be left exactly from the self once we take out all those aspects? That's the point that Nagel is pressing here. Back to the text. There is a close connection between our feelings about ourselves and our feelings about others. Guilt and indignation, shame and contempt, pride and admiration are internal and external side of the same moral attitudes. We are unable to view ourselves simply as portions of the world. We are unable to view ourselves simply as portions of the world. And from inside, we have a rough idea of the boundary between what is us and what is not, what we do and what happens to us, what is our personality and what is accidental handicap. Okay, I'll stop here on the quotation. So this is crucial for Nagel, that it's essential to us as human beings to have this distinction, which is not altogether clear, but its very existence is undeniable. The distinction between what is us and what happens to us, what we did and what happened to us. Okay? So regarding things that we own, we fear pride. Okay? Regarding things that other people do, we admire them. Okay? And the point is that this distinction is not the same as that between within our control, not within our control. Let me repeat this point. So we have this distinction which is crucial to our notion of the self, the distinction between what we do and what happens to us, what belongs to us and what is not. And this distinction is not the same, is not parallel to the distinction between what's within our control and what's outside our control. In other words, to put it clearly, many things, many things that are not within our control are regarded by us as things that we own, we did, a part of us, and so on. So Sophie mentioned the fact that I completed the marathon last week. I take kind of pride that that was an achievement. I'm happy. How much of that was within my control, do you think? Some of it, of course, was. A lot of that wasn't. Okay? And the same with many things in our lives. Many things that we do in our life are not within, completely within our control. Maybe some parts are. And still we take pride of pride on them. And we see them as part of us. Now, the point is that if we follow the kind of the anti-luck, anti-moral luck idea to its end, we are left with no self. The self shrinks to a point which you can't see anymore. Nothing is left. The self shrinks to kind of a complete abstraction of the will. And if you're determinist, that even that isn't the case, because even that act of the will is determined. But, okay. I'm running out of time, so let me just mention another line of argument in favor of moral luck, and then we'll open for discussion. So I want to mention another argument in favor of moral luck, which is more a moral argument and less, let's say, metaphysical one. I think this argument about the self is more metaphysical. And the moral argument runs like this. The Kantian project is to, so to say, purify morality from luck. And the argument is that a purified world would be a very bad place to live in. And it would be a very bad place to live in because a world without moral luck, a world where luck is completely neutralized, would be a world in which our responsibilities are determined only by factors over which we have control. So if, God forbid, a couple gives birth to a very sick child, although they did all the tests, everything that was within their control, they did okay. From a moral point of view, they are fine. But the world didn't cooperate with them. So why should they be more blameworthy for not taking care of this child than any other member of society? Why should this be their problem from a moral point of view? And why would their failure be attributed to them and not to society in general? After all, this part was not within their control. Moreover, the very idea of integrity, this virtue of integrity, seems to apply especially to such cases. A person of integrity is precisely the person that doesn't walk away when things don't work out as they should. Okay? So a person of integrity, in this case, would say, okay, our bad luck, we would have preferred a healthy child, but that doesn't mean we walk away, we take responsibility. Okay. I think I'll stop here. I'm going to open it for the discussion. Okay.